What was student life like? Well, pretty tough in lots of ways. Students were always technically foreigners. They'd come from someplace else to go to the universities. They were preyed upon by unscrupulous landlords, by innkeepers, by prostitutes, and sometimes even by their teachers themselves. The period of study was very long. The precise length, at least in the arts, depending somewhat on a student's preparation. As few as 3 or 4 years, as many as 8, to take the first degree. Degrees were awarded by public examination, before the faculty. They could just fire questions at you, instead of, as today, by the accumulation of credits. A very different system. Medieval students actually had to demonstrate that they knew something. The university has proved to be one of the most flexible and durable of all Western institutions. This really is quite an important legacy of the Middle Ages to the modern world. Now, to get a sharper sense of the Latin learning in the age of scholasticism, let's use some examples that will perhaps bring this forward in a more concrete way. Let's mention, for example, Thomas Aquinas. Now, we referred to him a moment ago for his Summas. Born again 1225, died in 1274. He was born in a small town south of Rome and sent at about the age of 5 to Monte Cassino, Benedict's great monastery, where his noble father expected him one day to become the abbot. But in 1240, Thomas was sent off to Naples to study arts. While he was there, he was attracted by the intellectual apostolate of the Dominicans. Remember one of those new mendicant orders we spoke of in an earlier lecture? His parents strongly opposed this, but nevertheless, in 1244, Thomas joined the Dominican order. In 1245, he went to Paris. He studied there for about 3 years, and then he and came under the influence of Albert the Great and of the newly emerging texts of Aristotle. Albert then transported himself to Cologne, and Thomas went with him, stayed there for a few years. In 1252, he came back to Paris. He taught there until 1259. He then departed, partly on the business of his order, the Dominicans, and partly for other academic responsibilities, to Italy. He stayed there until 1269, when he returned to Paris and taught until 1274, when he died at the relatively young age of 49. Thomas was a prolific writer, first of all. To stand in the library in front of the collected works of Thomas Aquinas is to be humbled. He made contributions to many of the great philosophical and theological problems of his days. His ideas were formed by his travels. They were formed by his experience in several schools. They were formed by the burgeoning contemporary interest in Aristotle, as well as in the Arab and Jewish commentators on Aristotle. They were formed by the practical needs of teaching, and they were formed by the increasing dominance of logic in the schools. Central to Thomas's thought was the problem of the relation between faith and reason. On the one hand, Thomas explored the respective roles of the will and of the intellect. Faith, for example, is a matter of the will. In consciously granting assent to something, I do not commit an act that is contrary to reason. Nevertheless, I may agree to something that is not demonstrable by reason. On the other hand, Thomas spoke of natural and revealed truths. Many things can be known by the unaided use of human reason. 2 and 2 is 4. Some religious things can be known by reason, too. Thomas thought, for instance, like Anselm, the existence of God. But there are some things that can only be known by faith, that can only be known by revelation. The Trinity, for example. The doctrine of the Trinity is not something to which reason will bring you. The doctrine of the Incarnation, God made man, is not something that reason will bring you to. Or, in a much more Aristotelian vein, creation out of nothing. Thomas's systematic exposition of Catholic teaching was always influential to a degree, but in the 19th century, it was made the basis for official Catholic teaching, official Catholic theology, and given the name Thomism, and it held that position until the Second Vatican Council between 1962 and 1965. Thomas's career, then, illustrates for us in a number of ways some of the fundamental cross-currents of this age. Yes, this is an urbanized world. It is a world of great wealth. It is a world of vast resources. It is a world where ideas are circulating more widely than ever before. It is a world where Latin learning is still dominant, is still regnant, though, as we'll see in our next lecture, it's beginning to be challenged by vernacular learning. It's a world where a series of great intellectual traditions are encountering one another seriously and for the first time. The scholastic culture of high medieval Europe is one, only one, but one of that remarkable period's most important achievements and legacies to the tradition of Western civilization.